ado, I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to Don. So,
thank you
very much for being here.
Thank you. And hi, everybody. My name is Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here this morning and grateful to see you sweet folks turning out this early for this. You know, anytime I do anything that's going to take a long time, and you all are fortunate because we only go in an hour and 10 or 15 minutes on this one, but if I'm doing something that goes all day on Saturday or maybe all weekend, the first thing that shocks me is that anybody shows up. But what really blows me away is when they come back after a break. You know, I don't understand that, but thank you, and we are calling this a workshop on 10, 11, and 12, steps 10, 11, and 12, that are frequently called the maintenance steps. The word workshop is not the word that I would choose for this, because I don't think that we can work the steps hard enough to get any benefit. I don't believe that at all. I believe that we need to simply follow the directions and take in the action. Sometimes we call it a step study. And by the way, I'm never on a soapbox saying you shouldn't call this, that, or the other. Other folks can call it whatever they want to. Yeah, I'm fine with that. But for me, it's not a step study, because my experience was that you can study the steps until you're blue in the face and you won't get a bit good out of it. It's all a matter of doing the action that's in there. And my sobriety date, by the way, is April 9th of 1981. And I got sober in Nashville, Tennessee. And I had an awful lot of trouble getting there, but I'll talk about that tonight. I want to talk about getting there and the step process. I was told very early in sobriety that the steps are the prescription for alcoholism, that they work on alcoholism exactly like penicillin works on an infection. They explain that if I have an infection that's going to kill me if it's not treated, but it will respond to penicillin, I don't need to understand the origin, width, breadth, and nature of my infection. And I don't need to aggravate the people around me in the medical profession whining about the origin, width, breadth, and nature of my infection. I don't need to understand a single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. I don't need to believe that that little bottle of pills can take care of all these terrible things wrong with wonderful me. And here's the real kicker. I don't need to want to take the pills. Whether I want to take the pills or not is totally irrelevant. If I take the pills as directed, I'll get just fine, thank you. And the steps have worked exactly that way for me in my life. My original sponsor was Cherry Carpenter, not Jerry, but Cherry was his first name, in Nashville, Tennessee. I got sober in Nashville, although other than three years in Nashville altogether, I have lived in Louisville, Kentucky all my adult life. But Cherry talked to me a good deal about the steps. He believed that the steps are the only program of recovery that we have. He explained that I can be a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous on any day that I've got a desire to stop drinking. It doesn't even have to be a honest desire anymore. They took that word out decades ago. You can be a member of the Fellowship of AA with a half-budded desire to stop drinking. and thank God that there's no other requirement for membership in the Fellowship other than that. But he explained that I might grab hold of the Fellowship, kind of like a parasite grab hold of a tree or something, and I might be going to 10 meetings a week, talking the best game of recovery you have ever heard in your life. But if I was not somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9, the way the book says do them, in order to reach a state of recovery, or having done 1 through 9, I was doing the action on a daily basis, that is steps 10, 11, and 12, in order to do the maintenance work on my recovery, if I'm not somewhere in that process, I'm not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that's called a program is numbered, 1 through 12. And if I try to do it that way, it was explained to me that I might stay dry a week, and in some fairly rare instances, I might stay dry 30 years. But they explained that if that happened, I probably wouldn't like what that looked like. to be a dry alcoholic for 30 years without any healing of what's really wrong inside of that disordered ego that we have, that's the basis of all of it, that inability to be comfortable inside ourselves, the disease inside us. But he also explained, and he was not on a soapbox, by the way. When I got sober in 81, it was just absolutely the understood drill in AA that you identified yourself as a recovering alcoholic. And really, in those times, if you heard somebody say, "I am a recovered alcoholic," oh, ego, he thinks he's cured, he's gonna drink again. Sherry stopped me one time when I just referred to myself as a recovering alcoholic and said, "I don't care what you call yourself, Don." And he explained he wasn't on a soapbox. But he said, "I do want you to be aware that the big book calls us recovered alcoholics." And by that time, I was pretty good big book scholar, you know, been sober 3 or 4 months and was pretty well read. And, of course, I'm a great deal smarter than Cherry anyway. And so I asked him where they had hid that in the big book. And he said, "Well, the first place that they hid it is in the subtitle of the book." I didn't even know the book had a subtitle. How many thousand men and women have recovered? And he said, "And then they called it that twice more in the first paragraph of the foreword to the first edition." And he explained, too, that steps 1 through 9, in his view, were the recovery program in its entirety. He believed that once we have done steps 1 through 9 the way the book says to do it, that we will have attained a state of recovery from our alcoholism. He also explained to me that in my case, he expected that to last about 8 seconds, that I would have to immediately begin using the action of 10, 11, and 12 in order to maintain my recovery and get my daily reprieve. And I asked him, "Well, what about going back through the steps? I hear people all the time talk about I did another fourth step or or this, that, or the other." He said, "That's fine." He wasn't on a soapbox, and I'm not on a soapbox, but he said that steps 10, 11, and 12 contain every single thing that's in the first 9 steps. The difference is that when I do a full-fledged inventory, taken right out of the book, page 64 through 70, it looks exactly like my fourth step look, but in my mind, it's not a fourth step. It's 10th step work of continuing to take personal inventory. Part of my morning meditation for 30 years, more than 30 years, has been reading the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. But in my mind, I'm not redoing my third step, and I'm not redoing my seventh step. I'm doing 11th step work of seeking to get in closer contact with my God. And he didn't explain to me why he made those 2 points. Number one, that we are called recovered alcoholics. And number two, that we should view ourselves as having finished the first 9 steps and be in a state of recovery. And everything we did from then on would be steps 10, 11, and 12. And it finally clicked in my brain probably when I was 4 or 5 years sober. It didn't click for a long, long time. The reason Cherry told me that, other than the fact that it's the case, is what the book says. He told me that because he knew me, and he knew my propensities for messing up. And he knew that if I got the idea to view myself as a poor little crippled, sick alcoholic who's never ever going to get all right, I'd just have to keep on marrying a little further down in the mud, but surviving a day at a time. He knew that I was perfectly capable of 25 years sober, sitting around the clubhouse playing euchre and whining about those earth people out there, that I can't go out there. I can't work with those folks. They don't understand me. You'd make me get drunk. So he didn't want to give me that excuse. He knew that I'd grab that excuse. He wanted me to understand that when I've done that deal, the first 9 steps right, and I'm doing the action, the steps 10, 11, and 12, I ought to be at least as well equipped to face this world on this world's terms as a person who never had alcoholism. he also said that if we were not supposed to do the first nine steps in order, they would not have numbered them. And he told me a little story, bringing home the need to stay right where we are in the steps rather than looking ahead. And it's what I call the Jack story. It's an alcoholic had a flat tire out on a dark, lonely country road really late at night. And the alcoholic looks in their trunk and they have a spare tire, but they don't have a jack. So the alcoholic says, oh, what am I going to do? And then he looks and sees way, way down the road a light. Well, he starts walking toward the light, and the committee in his head starts meeting, saying, what if that's not even a house? What if it's some kind of outbuilding? Or what if it's a house and nobody lives there? What if they live there and they won't answer the door this time of night, afraid of it? Well, what if they answer the door and I ask if they borrow their jack and they don't have a jack? But what if they do have a jack, but they won't loan it to me? What if they do loan me a jack, and I walk all the way back to that car, and it won't fit? About that time, he's gotten up to the porch of the farmhouse. He's knocked on the door. Old farmer stuck his head out the door and said, can I help you? The alcoholic said, I didn't want to borrow your damn jack anyway. So that, and really staying where we are in the steps, I'm so blessed because I get to work with a lot of guys one-on-one working through the steps, and I'll be at 8 and 9 on a couple of my guys right now. excuse me. The eighth step to me is a two-part step. The first part, A, is we made a list of people we harm, and B, made a list of people harmed and make, excuse me, I don't believe that. If I don't know the right step, we're in the wrong place this morning, folks. yes, step 8A is made a list of the person we had harmed, and B is became willing to make amends to them all. And the reason that I think I needed to break it down that way, and I suggest to folks I work with that they do it, if your brain is dealing with actually having to go and make amends for something, it may keep things off that list that would get on there otherwise. It's the same thing as in the fourth step. I believe that when we make our resentment list in the fourth step, that we are to have no thought whatsoever of where we have been wrong. When we make that list, the book says really that we were burned up. You know, we were sore. We were hot about the thing. We were angry. And the reason I think that is I wouldn't get everybody down there if my brain's going on with all this deal of I'm going to have to do this, that about this resentment. I would let a lot of resentments slip subconsciously or maybe semi-consciously. another reason to keep on doing the steps and doing them in order is this one. I bet you that 50 times or more over the years, I've had somebody come to me or call me and say something like, I did my fourth and fifth step 2 months ago, Don, or I did my fourth step 3 years ago, Don, fourth and fifth 3 years ago, and there's something wrong. I'm not better. In fact, I feel worse after having done the fourth and fifth step. It seems like things are getting worse. Well, invariably, when I start questioning them, maybe a little loving cross-examination about whether they have gone on with the rest of the steps after having done the fifth step, I start getting responses like, yeah, I think so. Yeah, mostly I have done that, and of course they haven't. And I don't believe 4 and 5 are designed to make us feel better in and of themselves. In fact, what we have done, we've had a lot of really, really ugly, rotting things buried in shallow graves all around us. And in 4 and 5, all we've done is dig them up, strew them all around our life. If we don't go through the rest of the step process, step 6 through 9, in order to get those things buried properly, we are not better, we are worse. So I think I need to stay absolutely in the moment and need to stay on the step that I'm working in with regard to the first 9 steps. Now, Cherry went on to tell me that with regard to the maintenance steps, 10, 11, and 12, that we can start doing those when we're 24 hours sober. We could start doing things that are in there. I was taken on a 12-step call when I was about 7 or 8 days sober, and I didn't say much on it, but I was there, and it was a really, really good experience for me. The guy was telling us what a genius he was and how intelligent he was, and that was his trouble. And he couldn't get his cigarette to his mouth. He kept hitting him on one side of the other, trying to smoke his cigarette. And I needed to see that. I needed to see that real, real much. And of course, we can start with our praying anytime. And certainly, as far as admitting we're wrong, we don't have to wait until we've done the first 9 steps to promptly admit that we're wrong. So, but once we have done those first 9 steps, and what I'm supposed to be talking to you guys about this morning are 10, 11, and 12, the maintenance steps. And the first thing I want to tell you about that is that I have trouble reading the big book. And the reason I have trouble reading the big book is I already know what it says. Now, if you already know what it says, like parts of my morning meditation routine, which I have not done 100%, but I've probably done 80% of the time the last 33 years, always includes reading some things from the big book. And it includes, in step 10, reading the part where we have a daily reprieve from our alcoholism, that we're not cured of it, and the daily reprieve is dependent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Well, for the first few years I was sober, if you had put me on a lie detector box and said, "Don, does the big book say that your daily reprieve is contingent on your spiritual condition?" I would have said, "Sure," and the needle would never have wavered. But one day God gave me the insight to see what the ink on the paper said rather than what I thought the book said. And, of course, it doesn't say, thank God, that it's dependent on our spiritual condition. It says that it is dependent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And, folks, that's the difference in day and night. It's the difference in these lights being on and one of you back there walking over the switch and turning it off. Because, you see, I can't do anything immediately about my spiritual condition. I don't have a wand to wave and say, oops, I've woken up in a bad spiritual condition. Let me get my condition adjusted here and go on with my life. So the bottom line was, as long as I was reading the book that way and believing that, on the days when I felt like that I was disconnected from God and disconnected from you guys and I didn't want to do anything, it didn't feel like anything was working, on those days I was just a sitting duck for getting drunk. That it just might happen that I would be struck drunk because my spiritual condition, as best I can tell, is El Crapo. However, I can wake up in the morning and feel disconnected from you guys, feel disconnected from God. I can have doubts about everything that I've come to believe about God and Alcoholics Anonymous and everything else. I can be in a real big hurry because I've got a big deal of mine that I need to go take care of, and I hope I talk about big deals a little later on, but big deals kill me, by the way. Anytime I make a big deal out of anything that is not God and not these 12 steps, what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. And when I do that, I'm back into ego, and I'm actually back into my alcoholic illness, that disorder of my ego. But I can wake up feeling like that, and I can make myself get on my knees and say my morning prayer. And it doesn't matter that the old crazy picture show in the back of my head is going to what I've got to do that day and thinking about 3 or 4 things over there. And it doesn't matter that it feels to me clearly that the words are bouncing off the walls and ceiling, and it couldn't possibly help as best I can tell. But if I get down there and I say those words, and then if I pick up my meditation book, and maybe my mind is so spinning that I can't remember the last word I just tried to read, that's a real chore, you know, to go through and try to get a word to stick on it. But Cherry Carpenter straightened that out for me. I want to take a little side trip to tell you this, because this is really, really important. When I was 3 or 4 months sober and had begun coming to believe, In fact, I thought I was getting rather spiritually erudite, thank you. I was having problems of waking up and my brain being spinning around and being scared, and I was so obsessed on myself and the fear that I couldn't remember the last word I just tried to pray. So, you know, I was telling Cherry that my prayers are not working. And he said, "Don, your ego's going to kill you yet." He said, "Let's examine that." He said, are you under the impression that God is not aware of your needs unless you clearly delineate them? He said, or maybe you believe that God is so lacking in power that he or she is somewhere wringing their hands and saying, "Oh, I so hope Don stumbles across the magic phrase that says this right. I do want to do it for him so badly, but I can't do it unless he says it just right." And Cherry went on, he said, "Don, actually in your case, I think it may be much more malignant than that." He said, "In your case, Don, I think you may have it in your head somewhere that you will state it so eloquently that you will sway God into doing something God wasn't going to do otherwise." He said, "Dummy, the only thing that's of any value whatever is getting on your knees morning and night and humbly asking and thanking the power greater than yourself." And that's when he began to help me and it began to form with me. And the next thing that I'm going to say, please, please don't think that I'm knocking the medical profession, that I'm knocking alcohol and drug counselors, I'm a treatment center. I'm not knocking anybody. I'm a disciple of page 133 of this big book, where it tells us that God has filled this world with wonderful doctors and counselors, and I am not to hesitate to use them when they are needed. And I believe that with all my heart. And I have a whole lot of sponsees that have asked me, "Don, my doctor does this and suggesting that I take that. What should I do?" I tell them, "Good God, man, I'm a lawyer, not a doctor. I don't know what you need to take." And, you know, I tell them to make sure that the doctor knows their full alcohol and drug history. And then if the doctor knowingly says that, my best advice is a hands-off. You know, you follow what the doctor says. I'm not going to override the doctor in this situation. But I do think that if we take our alcoholism to the medical profession or to counselors rather than to these 12 steps, it's a whole lot like taking a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. There's just nothing in us that they can work on. I have long suspected, although we will never ever know the answer to this, I have long suspected that the counselors couldn't help us even if one of us did tell them the truth. So I believe that if I approach prayer or these steps or any part of my recovery or my alcoholism in any way as an intellectual process or as a psychological process, they won't work any better than all the intellectual and psychological things have worked through the history on alcoholism. In other words, zip, nada, not at all. It isn't until I'm willing to just take the action and let God take it from there that it begins to work. But I'm back to my morning now, where I talk about the 10th step, where I have awakened and I feel cut off from God, cut off from you. Don't want to pray, don't want to do anything that I'm supposed to do, want to do everything that I don't need to do and that I shouldn't do. And make myself get down on the knees and say that prayer. Middle of the morning, and get a call, and I don't think I'm sponsoring a Joe, so we're going to call him Joe. Get a call from sponsee Joe, and the receptionist answers the phone. Now, Joe, just like everybody that I have ever sponsored, was told at the beginning of the relationship that for me to give advice on boy-girl relationships really ought to be a felony, and that I was not in a position to give him advice in that regard. But nonetheless, Joe has called me 8 times in the last 24 hours to talk about the girl. There's very little on the face of this earth in which I am less interested than in Joe and the girl. And every fiber of my being wants to tell that receptionist, "Oh, God, to tell him I'll call him back." But what I can do instead of doing that, I can take a deep breath, can lean back in my chair and pray those wonderful all-day 11th step prayers. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And then from the 12 and 12, prayer of St. Francis. Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Job, rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. And I can run that through my head a couple of times, and I can tell Andrea, put him through. And I can pick up that phone, and I can say, good morning, Joe. How are you, buddy? What can I do for you? And then there's a meeting right across the Ohio River from my office at noon at what used to be the Jeffersonville Tolkien Club. It's not right there anymore, but the point of what I'm saying is exactly the same. I'd been to that meeting hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of times. It meets at noon 5 days a week. It's 5 minutes from my office downtown Louisville. And I know I've got really bad hearing problems. Even with hearing aids, the acoustics in that room are so bad that I don't hear one word out of five or understand one word out of five that people are saying in this discussion meeting. And it wouldn't make a difference if I did, because I know all of them. I've heard everything they got to say more times than that. And the big deals I'm working on there in my office are so pressing and of such moment that it would just be irresponsible to get up and go to that silly meeting where I can't possibly get anything out of it instead of stay here and work on my big deals. But I can make myself shake my head and say, God gave me the strength to do the right thing, especially when I don't want to. And I can go get in my car and I can pray the magic prayer, Lord, please don't let me be concerned about what I can get out of this. Please let me be focused on what I might be able to bring to it, on what I might be able to do to help one of God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. And I can sit down in that meeting and go through it, and I can go through my entire day that way. Now, my mind and my feelings may not have changed in the whole process of the day. I may still feel as cut off as I did when I woke up that morning. But because I've done that action, I am absolutely convinced that I am promised by the big book, if I do the action that's the maintenance of my spiritual condition after doing steps 1 through 9, that I will not drink that day. The 10th step has got all sorts of good stuff in it. Well, one thing it's got in it is the AA code. I didn't know AA had a code for several months after I got sober, and the code is love and tolerance of others. Some of my dear friends out west, I have mentioned them time to, that pointed out it does not say that responsibility and accountability is our code. It says that tolerance and love of others is our code. And I have found out with regard to tolerance that it is not what I thought it was. I thought, if what you're doing is sort of irritating to me, but I can shrug it off and go on, that I was being tolerant. I understand now that tolerance is not an issue until I find the situation intolerable, where everything in my body and my soul wants to straighten you out, that somebody's got to set the record straight, and it's God's will, I believe, for me to do it. It's like forgiving. You know, if you cut me off in traffic, if I don't want to forgive you and I'm willing to have a bellyache for 5 or 10 minutes, I don't have to get you to forgive you. I'm not going to get drunk about that, but molest my child, steal my retirement money, run away with my beloved spouse, I better forgive you if I want to live. The things that I must absolutely forgive are the unforgivable, and the things that I must tolerate are for me the intolerable. And I believe in tough love. And I use tough love. But I use tough love, I try to do it, only after I've weighed it in the balance with compassion and kindness. If I've got any doubt, after praying and doing what I need, sometimes it's talking to other people, but I've got any doubt that tough love is the route I should take rather than kindness, I want to err on the side of kindness. And I've been asked why I want to do it that way, and the best answer I've ever came up with for me is that I would a whole lot rather my tombstone say Don was kind than to say Don didn't take any crap. So at any rate, that's my take on the AA code for me. promptly admitted it. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. The continued to take personal inventory takes so many different forms. It's a daily inventory as we go along, keeping things clean. I consider it a part of the inventory, even though it's actually in the 11th step on page 86, where it says, when we retire, we run those questions through our mind about our day. You know, had we kept something to ourselves that should have been discussed with another person, so on. And by the way, the last sentence of that paragraph says, we got to be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. And it doesn't say, and then we might not sleep well. And it doesn't say, and then we may not seem as spiritual as we want to seem. What it says is, we don't get slip into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because that might diminish our usefulness to others. And folks, that's what it's all about as far as I'm concerned. I think it's shot all the way through the steps. I know that I have an illness that is self-centeredness. There's no question. Where it talks about the third step, the book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And what that's meant to me for years is the first thing wrong with me is that ego disorder inside myself. And all the other alcoholic things have built up based on that. Every few years I have wound up doing a full written inventory that looks exactly like a fourth step. Now, I don't have a time schedule that I do, whatever, 2 years on this week or something. I don't have any schedule at all. I do them usually when I've had a major change in my life. You know, things are substantially different than they were. Or if I just get out of sorts and something's wrong, that sometimes will drive me to it. So that's part of continuing to take personal inventory as far as I'm concerned. And the other part, the part B of the 10th step, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Cherry explained to me that the word promptly was in there purely for my comfort. That if I wanted to be comfortable eventually, I could eventually admit I was wrong. But if I wanted to be comfortable promptly, I better promptly admit that I was wrong. That has been a wonderful tool for me. It's been a behavior-changing thing for me. And let me tell you how that works. Somebody has given me a little legal job. I'm a lawyer. Give me a little legal job that they want me to do for them. Frequently it's something that I really don't want to do. It's not something in the area of what I'm doing. Very frequently it's something I'm not charging for. I'm doing it for nothing. But sometimes it is something that I'm charging for. And I've said, I'll get into it. 2 or 3 weeks go by, and it hasn't moved from that corner of the desk. In fact, it's got several things piled on top of it since it came to rest on that corner of the desk. And then I pick up the phone in the afternoon, and lo and behold, it is that person. It is almost automatic to say, did my paralegal not get that out? Good Lord, well, let me talk to him or her about that, and we'll see what I can do. That truly is just about, not even on purpose, just, bleh, it goes out. But many years ago, my friend Billy H and I, Billy's last name's Hogue, he doesn't care, Billy and I decided that we were going to really do the 10th step promptly and thoroughly. And I think I called back 2 or 3 of those people, you know, right just a few minutes after I hung up, said, you know, I need to tell you, I just lied to you. My paralegal didn't have anything to do with that. I hadn't even given it to him. It's still on the same corner of the desk, and I'm just such an alcoholic, whatever. And they were understanding. In fact, we usually kind of laughed at it, but I won't tell you, it broke me. It broke me from telling those automatic little white lies like that. If you make yourself go back and clean them up at once, it's been my experience that it really, really, really will clean up life. Going through the maintenance steps, I'd like to ask you to keep a couple of definitions in mind. Definitions are really important to me because the words themselves are important. I found out that whatever I call or name something or somebody is going to have more to do with the reality to me of that person or that thing than probably any other single factor. The first word is a biggie for me. The word is attitude. And I think, I'm sure all of you had a similar situation to mine. When I got sober in Nashville, it seemed like from every corner I was getting, you need to have a good attitude. You need to make your attitude one of gratitude. If you don't change your attitude, you're going to get drunk. Well, I didn't even think about it because I had known all my life what attitude is. It's the way I think and feel about something. It's my mindset. That's my attitude. So Cherry finally sent me to a particular dictionary to look up the word attitude. And I looked it up, and the first definition didn't have anything to do with what I was thinking or feeling or my mindset. The first definition was a term from geometry and aviation. It was defined as angle of approach. And folks, that was like turning that light switch on and off, because instantly my attitude went from something totally beyond my control to something absolutely and totally within my control. Because my angle of approach to you, my angle of approach to anything in my life, is the way I act toward you or toward that person or thing. So that has been gold for me in terms of keeping that in mind of what my attitude is and that I have the control of my attitude. Another word that's been really important to me throughout sobriety is realize. All my life I had thought, to the extent I thought about it, I don't think I ever thought about it. I had just assumed and accepted as an absolute fact that to say I know that or I realize that was synonymous. It was the same thing, interchangeable. And of course it's not. Realize is a form of the word real. So literally to realize something means that it has been made real inside me. It has been brought into reality. And folks, the things that I've known for 30 years that I have not realized, that have not become real inside me. A third word, and now I'll leave the vocabulary lesson there for this one. The word is decision. All my life, when I had formed an intention, I thought I'd made a decision. I thought they were synonymous. And if I'd formed an intention to go to New York tomorrow, I'd tell you, I made a decision. I'm going to New York tomorrow. But I've learned a great truth in sobriety. I don't make decisions with my brain. I just think I do. I make decisions with my feet. So an intention for me does not graduate into being a decision until I have begun taking the action on it to bring it into reality. And that has been so helpful. It's been so helpful to be careful not to misname an intention as a decision until I've begun taking the action and it's graduated into the area of into the area of actually being decision. The 10th step promises are some pretty neat promises, and by the way, I'm no soapbox, but there are promises all through this book. The 10th step promises are beautiful. The 3rd step promises are beautiful. The 11th step promises are just absolutely the most practical thing on this earth. So I believe any of those promises is as significant as the 8th and 9th step promises, which we call the promises. And if somebody asks me to read the promises, I don't get up and say, let me straighten you people out on the promises. These are not the promises. Apparently somebody decided one time that you could argue that there are 12 of those. You can also argue that there are 11 or 13 of them. And I don't believe that in writing the big book that it was intended that those would be the promises as far as being exclusive promises. Some of the others are beautiful. The 10th step promises talk about me being brought into a position of neutrality with regard to alcohol. And it also refers in my mind back to step 2. As to what the sanity that we talked about being restored to is, it says we'll react sanely toward alcohol. I think sometimes we get it in our mind that we are supposed to be given absolute solid rock sanity because we have done the first 9 steps. Nobody ever promised us that particular rose garden. What we are promised is sanity with regard to alcohol and our relationship to it. Don Prietz, who died a few years ago, there was a prayer that is called Don Pritz's Prayer. He always denied that it was his, but it goes something like this. Lord, please let me set aside everything I think I know about you, my recovery, the steps, you know, on the big book, so forth, so that I can have a new experience with you, myself, big book, steps, and so on. And that's been so, so helpful to me. So helpful to me to realize that this whole thing is based on me coming like a little child. I've already mentioned that I can't approach it from an intellectual or psychological point of view and get it to work at all for me. But when I really do come to this program, being in the 12 steps, like a little child, and start trying to go through that book line for line, reading only the black part, not looking for anything to learn or argue with or to memorize, but looking only for what it says do, that's when the real action starts to happen for me. The other thing that's just wound all through it, and I started to mention this a minute ago, the third step prayer, ask God to take away my difficulties, not so that I can be sober and spiritual and happy, but take away my difficulties that Victory Road then will bear witness to those I would help of God's love and God's power and God's way of life. Of course, the seventh step prayer, which I misunderstood and did not realize that it may, I could have quoted it backwards. I really could have. I could have sat down at a table with you, and if you'd given me 5 minutes, I believe I could have started with the last word and quoted that prayer backwards to you. I knew what the words were that well. And I just somehow was missing that it doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. And it certainly does not ask God to remove all the defects of character that are making my self-centered butt uncomfortable. It asks God to remove the defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. And I have not a clue which ones they are. I can look back on my life in sobriety and I can see how character defects that stuck with me so long and so painfully and so embarrassingly into sobriety. At the time I was going through it, I couldn't see at any good how any good could ever happen to it. I thought the central office AA probably ought to blackball me, anybody that act like that, think like that. But in looking back on it, when my phone rings or somebody knocks on my door and they ask me to do something for AA or to give them some help for something, I really think that probably 3/4 of the time, the fact that I lived through those things sober and struggled with them so long and finally got to a point where I began to get relief from them, I think 75% of the time I'm asked to do something in AA that I'm asked because of that. But I couldn't see when I was going through it how God could possibly weave that into anything that would be helpful to anybody. And of course, when I did my fourth and fifth step, I formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to be. And that's what I thought 6 and 7 were, was where with God's help I went to work on me to make me into what I decided a spiritual Don ought to be. And also, every morning in my life, I'm reading on page 87 that many of us have wasted a lot of time praying for our own selfish ends. It doesn't work. You can easily see why. Well, it took me between 8 and 9 years to easily see why me praying for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone is precisely the same spiritual mistake as me praying for a bright red Ferrari. I'm praying for my own selfish ends because I don't know what needs to be left there. I don't know what needs to be woven in which way by my God so that I can be of more use to other human beings on this earth. Step 11. Up until May of 1990, I was 9 years sober at that point. Up until May of 1990, there's no question in my mind that on a daily basis, the 11th step was the most important and most used step in my sobriety. It's still awfully important, and I still use it an awful lot, but for the last 24, 25 years, step 6 and 7 have been so, so important to me, and I believe they have been the center of my life. I'll tell you real quickly how that worked. I was so in such pain about lots of things. I was 9 years sober. I was giving talks all over the country, and I was sponsoring an embarrassingly large number of men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And while all this was going on, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos was killing me. It was absolutely eating my lunch. And I was working so hard on it. And I didn't have bad objectives. I had good, sane, solid spiritual objectives. I didn't want all the women in the world. I wanted a halfway sane, monogamous relationship where a woman and I could be comfortable with one another and get through a day at a time. With regard to the money, I didn't want to be wealthy. I just wanted the insanity to stop and all the chaos to stop. And I'd grab whatever character defect was bothering me by the collar, slam it up against the wall, and say, "Come here, God, give me a little help. We'll get rid of this sucker." And God never came a single time. And, of course, it was because I was looking at it wrong. It wasn't where I went to work on me with God's help. It's where I gave up on working on me. It's where I just said, "Hey, I will never figure out these patterns of my life, God. I've got less chance of figuring out or understanding the patterns of my life than a chimpanzee does of mastering quantum physics. I'm just simply not equipped to do that, but there's a little spark of you inside me, a little spark of the divine in every one of us." In fact, 24 Hourberg mentioned that a few days ago. And that little spark of the divine, I was taught, and I believe with all my heart, knows only right now. It doesn't know 5 years ago. It doesn't know 5 seconds ago. It doesn't know 5 seconds from now or 5 years from now. But if I will listen to that spark, it will tell me where to take the next stitch only. And I've been stumbling that way since May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober. And most days, I felt like I was doing it so poorly that I couldn't possibly get any help out of it. But I've kept on stumbling in that same direction. You know, take a couple steps in the right direction, get knocked on my butt by self-will. And I'm not talking about that happening twice a week. I'm talking about days where it happens 50 or 100 times a day that I get knocked over by the self-will and I got to get up and brush my, "Oh, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry, I did it again." Stumble another couple steps in the right direction. And I thought that every time that happened, it was an interruption or a break in my spiritual growth. And I understand now that that process of stumbling and falling and getting up and keeping on stumbling in the right direction is the only spiritual growth of which I am capable. And it seems like my God is very, very content with that. My God seems not to require perfection of me. In fact, my God seems not to really even require consistency. My God seems to be just fine with persistence, keeping on getting up, falling down, stumbling in the right direction. And bottom line is, even though I haven't felt like I was doing it well enough that it'd do me any good, if in May of 1990, 9 years sober, I had made a list of everything that I wanted from every area of my life, and God had said, "Don, I'm sick of your whining. I'm giving you precisely what you've written down that you believe is the best you could have. I'm not grandstanding. I'm not trying to be dramatic. This is simply the truth." If God had given me what I wanted, I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm truly willing to come as a little child, and I'm truly willing to listen for that spark and take that next stitch over and over again, regardless of what my brain's telling me, where I know in my heart it's right, when my brain's saying, "Boy, if you don't take a little more than your share here, you won't be all right. You won't be able to buy this. You won't be able to pay that. You know, if I tell this rigorously honest, it's really going to look bad. I can tweak it just a little bit, you know, and just a little tiny bit. But if I don't fall into that, I wind up going in the right direction." On awakening is the way the 11th step starts out. After I was 3 or 4 months sober, I went to Cherry and asked him when and how I should begin my daily 11th step. And he got the book out and he pointed to, got to 86 and pointed out that it says, on awakening, blah, blah, blah. And basically it says on awakening that we think about 24 hours a day. And before we even start that, we ask God to direct our thinking, that ask that it be divorced from self. from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. He said, "Don, if you were supposed to do that after you went to the bathroom, instead of on awakening, it would have said after you peed, you would have done that." He said, "So you need to try to condition yourself to do it the first thing when your eyes fly open." And over the years, I've I'm not going to say that it goes through my head immediately every day, but way more mornings than not, something the first two or three thoughts through my head is to ask God to direct my thinking and save me from those things. Cherry said there were two reasons why I needed to do exactly what the book said on that. He said the first one was that I so desperately needed the discipline of following any directions that if following any direction would be of great benefit to me. And he said the second reason was that he believed me to be perfectly capable of getting crazy enough between the bed and the bathroom to throw away my entire life. So over the years after I did, now that goes through my head, but I don't get on my knees at that point. I go ahead and I get my caffeine nicotine levels to suit me, and then I get on my knees and ask God to get me through the day and thank God that morning. And by the way, when I got sober, finally got sober, I was told on that praying that I better do it and that it didn't matter what my brain thought about it. And my brain thought it was about the stupidest thing anybody could do. But for I know what reason, started to say for some reason, and I know exactly the reason, because of a loving gift from a loving God. I was motivated even though I didn't believe it would work and I didn't want to do it. Late April 1981, I started getting on my knees every morning, every night. And, of course, the miracle of the second step began to happen. I began to come to believe. As far as I know, I haven't missed a morning or night except a few nights when I've been in the hospital. And in the last 24 years, my wife, Sharon, has knelt by the hospital bed, and we've said the prayers that way. And I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. I'm telling you that to let you know that over half the time and all those thousands of mornings and nights I've gotten down there, over half the time I hadn't really wanted to. Big percentage of the time, I really, really didn't want to. A whole lot of times I could have gotten a written medical excuse from a doctor and I didn't feel like getting down there. And even more times than that, I could have gotten affidavits from lawyers and judges and clients that I sure didn't have time to get down there. But point is that I've gotten down there every morning and night and something's worked every single day. And I don't know of anything that's more important to my 11th step than that, of doing that in the mornings. Also, Sharon, my wife, and I have a keynote for the day. And there's six things that are written down on identical little pieces of paper. And those pieces of paper have been there 25 years. They're just about to fall apart. And I don't know what I'm going to do with them when those are gone. But they have on them humility, honesty, gratitude. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. Pray to love, comfort, and understand. And help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. And we draw that, we draw what happens when I'm at home. I hold the book out where I've got things folded up and there. Sharon draws one and reads it. And that's our keynote for the day. Now, I have known all along that in one way, it doesn't make any difference what spiritual principle I'm concentrating on. Because if I'm concentrating on any valid spiritual principle, my behavior will be exactly the same as if I were concentrating on another. If I'm concentrating on honesty, it'll be the same as if I were concentrating on gratitude. If I'm concentrating on gratitude, it'd be the same that I would need to concentrate on with regard to honesty. However, what seems to be so very important for me, and Sharon says it is for her too, is that I have a keynote. It gives me something to help keep in the forefront of my mind how I'm supposed to be doing it, that I'm not supposed to be, that what I am is a little ant floating down the river on a log. Left to my own devices, I'm an ant that thinks he can steer the log, and I'm running back and forth, driving myself crazy, and of course the log's going on where it's going anywhere, whereas if I could just stop and take care of little ant crappy things to do that ants can do, and quit worrying about steering the log, I'd be a very happy and productive ant. But that doesn't come to me naturally. We have to work on me a bit before I become a productive ant. But, and of course, in the evening, it's the same thing. And I already mentioned the page 86 is actually in the 11th step. I've always thought I need to rewrite the big book, put it in the 10th step, but I guess they're not going to let me do that. And I guess it doesn't make a difference which step it's in. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Then the questions start getting harder. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? And then I already talked about that last sentence, says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. And I never quite finished the thought of that idea of it being all about what we can do for others, being at the absolute center of the 12 steps in our recovery. I didn't mention steps 8 and 9, I don't think. Now, everybody knows that steps 8 and 9 are about putting our lives back in order and cleaning up our past, right? Well, on page 77, it says, yeah, we're doing that all right, but it's not our real purpose. Our real purpose, it's not an end in itself, it says. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people around us. So it's everywhere. And I've got this illness that absolutely is self-centeredness. I can't treat it by more obsession on self. It doesn't make any difference how I dress up self-obsession. And I've got an entire wardrobe for self-obsession to dress it up, and so I can kid myself into saying it's not self-obsession. I've got spiritual outfits. I've got psychological outfits. I've got responsibility outfits. And I can dress up my self-obsession and maybe kid myself for a while. And I suppose it's right that I work so hard on being self-obsessed, because nothing has ever made me as exquisitely miserable as obsessing on myself. And with what I've got wrong with me, trying to get better or treat what's wrong with me by self-obsession is exactly like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. You just can't do it. With what's wrong with me, I've got to quit worrying about my braggity butt so much. And I've got to look around to God's kids and see where this is all courtesy of Chuck Chamberlain. And look around to God's kids and ask myself, what can I do that they need to have done? And what can I do for free and for fun? At night, it's just running through that paragraph that I just read and praying on my knees. My wife and I pray together. At night, we don't in the morning. We both do separate praying. She's not in 12-step program. Doesn't need to be. She wakes up more spiritual than I can get after 2 hours of intensive meditation and maybe throwing in 20 minutes of intensive work with another alcoholic. And yet, sometimes I have to catch myself saying, well, Sharon, honey, what do you know about spirituality? You're not even an alcoholic. Well, I know we tend to that, you know. But if you get real realistic, man, I kind of think this is the deal. I kind of think in December 1934, God took pity on a bunch of spiritual retardees and put it in such a simple form that even we could benefit from the wonderful spirituality that people have been enjoying for millennia. And I believe that with all my heart. Now, I've done some practical stuff with regard to the 11th step. That deal of the little six things we have and having a keynote for today, that's practical. I have done a lot of things like opening the room or the car door for God to get in before I go in. I am so grateful for Bluetooth and cell phones, because not nearly as many people think I'm insane at traffic lights, sitting in there talking to myself. Because that helps me with my conscious contact with God. I have also done things like wad up just a little piece of paper and put it in my coat pocket so that when I reach in there, I would touch it, and I would know that would remind me, oh, yeah, I'm not supposed to be doing it this way. I'm supposed to be trying to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. Just any little thing like that to remind me that I'm trying to improve my conscious contact with God. And those little practical things, they sound silly, but they really, really have been of great value to me. Now, I don't have a whole lot of trouble with the morning and the night. I got a really, really good record on that. What I have trouble with is the other 98% of the 11th step. I'm just figuring the morning and night taking about 1% of the 24-hour period each. It's that other 98%, and yet I've got a tendency, I think a lot of us do, to feel like if we have done the morning and the night thing, that we have done our 11th step that day. But some of the most powerful language in this book is a little paragraph that begins at the very bottom of page 87 and winds up on the top of 88. And I don't want to bore you by reading, but I do want us to focus on this. It says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves that we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, and then in quotation marks, just let you know that they're giving us specific instructions, thy will be done. And then, in the same paragraph, there's absolutely no question that what we're about to read here, the 11th step promises, they're not contingent on doing our morning deal. They're not contingent on doing our night deal. They are contingent upon and are the fruit of taking God with us in the 11th step with us through the other 98% of the day. And here are those promises. See if any of them would be needed in your life. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And then it's followed by the shortest paragraph in the big book. It works. It really does. And it really does work. Want to move on and talk a little bit about step 12. Of course, step 12 is the heart of so much for all of us. You know, if I didn't have any other reason to believe in God, and believe me, I've got a lot of reasons to believe in God, but if I didn't have any other reason, the divinely perfect deal that the only people that a sick, practicing alcoholic can usually hear with regard to their plight and what to do it's us, other alcoholics. We're the only ones that they can usually hear. And the only way we can stay sober is to make sure we take it to them and let them hear it. And to me, that is divine, divinely perfect closing of the circle. To paraphrase the first couple of sentences of the chapter Working with Others, it says that practical experience has shown that nothing, prayer, meetings, sponsors, nothing will so much ensure our immunity from drink as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other methods fail. And folks, my sobriety for 33 years a day at a time in my life are an absolute testament to the truth and the validity of that little reading. Because sometimes I think I've made every possible spiritual mistake in the last 33 years. Sometimes I think the only two things that I've done right at all are I've gotten on my knees morning and night and haven't drank. So I've made a world of mistakes. But I have found out that, thank God, and I don't give myself any credit for this because it seems like God just gave me this. I try to never fail to do what I can do anytime somebody's reaching out and there's an opportunity to intensively work with another alcoholic. One thing comes to my mind on that. It was 1989. I know exactly when it was. And the guy who's been sober as long as I have, but was doing a new inventory, Frank P., and I'm still old Frank's sponsor, and I was going through literally the divorce from hell. I had an accident drinking that I'll tell my story tonight, but that kept me in the hospital for a little more than 6 months out of the next year and lost bodily functions and all that sort of thing. Half dozen major surgeries in the first year. I want to tell you, those things were just a walk in the park compared to that divorce. It was awful. And this particular morning, I knew I shouldn't answer the phone, but I did because I still sleep, and it was the lady that we were going through the divorce with on the other end of the line, and I didn't want to hang up. I sat there without coffee and thing, listened for about 20 minutes of what a common SOB I was and all the things she was going to make sure happened to me. So I'm just leveled. and I got off the phone probably at 8:30, and I had an appointment with Frank to listen to his inventory, you know, do what would be a fifth step if we were calling that a fourth step. And everything in me said, man, I can't concentrate on this. I got to call Frank and move this. But it didn't. It didn't seem like the right thing to do. And I began to run through my head, thou will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand rather than love, be loved, comfort, and understood. And I went on and I met with Frank. And you know, we weren't 10 minutes into listening to Frank until that miracle had happened. That miracle that for just a little while, Frank became more important to me than me and my divorce and all the other things. And you know, when that happens, another great miracle happens. I found out that if any part of me is trying to get you to love, comfort, or understand me, and by that, that includes things like making sure you respect me, making sure you give me my rights. If any part of me is coming from there, I found it to be an absolute spiritual law. I will not be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. It can't happen. If you do exactly what I thought I wanted you to do before you're through, I'll change it. The only time that it's possible for me to feel loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction is when I've used that 11th step over and over, thou will be done, I'm no longer running the show. And by the way, Cherry explained to me that the book says we constantly remind ourselves that we're no longer running the show because I'm constantly trying to run it. But at any rate, when I do that and I get that beautiful miracle of you becoming more important than me just for a minute, and all the other tracks of my brain shut off, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say, and I'm thinking about how it'll look or how it'll sound, I really am thinking about you, the miracles happen. And one of the miracles is I wind up loved, comforted, and understood beyond my wildest dreams. Of course, I like it when that happens, so I try to grab hold of it, and squirt, I got to start all over again. But it's a great cycle. I was giving a talk about a year ago someplace, and I don't even remember how I led into it, but I made the statement that I believed I had been in the fourth dimension of existence at least 5,000 times. And then it hit me. Man, if I've been in there 5,000 times, that means I've fallen out of it 4,999. And for me, that's what it is. I can't take up permanent residence in that fourth dimension, but I sure do enjoy getting to camp there a little while sometimes. And, you know, the 12th step is worded about carrying the message. Thank God that word is not deliver. If the word were deliver, it'd be way too big a job for any of us. And we all carry a message all time, every day, every night, 24 hours. Now, we're not usually or frequently aware of the message that we're carrying, but we carry a message. And it's so helpful to accept, and this is a pure, pure gift from God for me, because it's not what my nature would be. I sponsor, as I say, an awful lot of guys, an awful lot of them. And if I made it a big deal, my sponsorship, that I was responsible with whether they got it or not, I was responsible with whether they drank or not, it'd break my back. I couldn't sponsor 10% of the guys I sponsor if I was coming from there. But the acceptance that I can lovingly do what I can do a step at a time, and I'm not big enough to get anybody sober, and I'm not big enough to make anybody drink. And by the way, it's not just in that, it's in my work too. I no longer win or lose cases. I'm not that big. I've just got a little job to do of doing my very best to within the bounds of honesty and ethics, zealously represent my client. And where it falls beyond that is something that's just way, way beyond my control. And it all works so much better because I don't get wiped out by ego hangovers or get so depressed when I lose. But at any rate, whatever it is, whether it's law or whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm much better coming off with prayer to love, comfort, and understand. The same principle is if I ask myself the question, what can I get out of this? And think about it for about 20 seconds, the answer will be not enough. So that's just the wrong question. The right question for me is what can I bring to this? And when I ask that question, run it over and over in my mind, I wind up getting more out of it than I could possibly imagine. Sponsorship is really important to me. Terry Carpenter in Nashville, I asked to sponsor me 5 or 6 days after my most recent drink in April of 81. I don't know why I asked him, because I did not like Terry, and I knew that Terry did not like me. I had been in Nashville going to meetings and drinking for 6 months before that time. And Terry and I never became great buddies. In the 9 years that he was a sponsor to me, we never rode in an automobile together one single time. We never shared a meal one single time. Cherry never called me except to return my telephone call, but he called and returned it every time, and he had his hand out to guide me through the steps. I have often wondered what would happen if I had asked Cherry to borrow $5. It would have been a bloodbath. It would have just been awful. So Cherry and I weren't friends as such. We were sponsors, and that worked for me. And if you knew, we're all out of perfect sponsors, guys. You're not going to find a perfect sponsor. Cherry told me things that are just absolutely invaluable, just wonderful. But I honestly believe that Cherry's wisdom and his great experience was only 1% of the value of that sponsorship relationship for me. I think it's true of all sponsorship relationships. I think 99% of it was my willingness to do what Cherry directed. Because if anybody, we get anybody that's got some sobriety and they've done the steps, they're not going to steer you the wrong way. They're going to tell you, you know, good stuff. And if we follow what's saying, there is the value. It isn't going to unlock some psychological or intellectual door. We're going to get the benefit from having done the action, like following the dots. A kid doing a follow the dots picture where the kid doesn't know what the picture's going to be, but if the kid will draw here, 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 the picture will emerge. And that's exactly the way it works for me. Practicing these principles in all of our affairs. I usually talk about some ideas that are so helpful to me. One of them is that I'm just like a little Western Union messenger boy. Now, none of us remember Western Union messengers, but I've got this picture in my head of a young guy on a bicycle pedaling around with his little uniform on. If that little fellow took responsibility for the content of his message or for the reaction of the person that got the telegram, nobody could do that job. It'd be way too hard. His job is just simply the quiet, loving delivery of the telegram. My job is the quiet, loving, compassionate telling of the truth. I don't have any control over the reaction to it. Usually, although I've tried so hard, I've never been able to create the truth. The truth at any moment just is. And my responsibility is to quietly and lovingly and with compassion to do that. And talking about the compassion, Cherry taught me that honesty without compassion is not really honesty. It's a form of hostility. And I have to weigh in, and I'm glad I do. I always weigh those in the balance. I think I mentioned it earlier. I weigh compassion and honesty in the balance, and compassion is a big, big factor in it. Bad hands. I ran into a fellow in May of 1990 who was sober, hadn't drank anyway, for 20 years. He lived in Cleveland, had owned some truck dealerships up there, had a world of money, didn't drink, but got to having a bunch of affairs and gambling and so on, and lost everything, wound up owing the government $2 million in employee withholding taxes. And they get all bent out of shape out of that. You know, he wasn't paying the employees' taxes that he was withholding. So he had to live underground. He was living in Las Vegas in underground. And I was interested in it. It turned out he was making his living playing poker and had been doing that for 7 or 8 years. And I asked him, Jim, how do you do that? You know, I know a lot of guys that would love to play poker for a living, and I've never known anybody else that was able to do it and succeed. And he said, well, Don, it's all about what we do with the bad hands. He said, any idiot can play the good hands. But the difference when the end of the day between losing and winning is going to be what we did with the bad hands. And I've learned over the 25 years since then that applies to every area of my life. You know, I want it to be all about riding that crest of everything creepy, but that's not what it's all about. Anybody can do that. When the deal looks so bad to me, I just want to throw it down, don't even want to look at it. How I react to that and what I do about trying to take that next step in the next, that stitch in the next right place, that is what's going to be determined of my success or my failure. And I view success, by the way, 3 minutes. Okay. I view success, in my mind, this is the only sports metaphor, thank God, today, but it's the bottom of the ninth in baseball game. My team's behind by 3 runs. The bases are loaded. There are 2 outs, and the count batting, and the count on me is 3-2. Well, obviously, I hit it out of the park on just a frozen rope, and everybody goes, wow. That's my vision of what success for me would be like. What success is like in the same metaphor is this. My uniform has holes in it. I've got the flu. It looks like it's going to rain. They're not going to have the game anyway. The manager hates my guts, and he wouldn't put me in for anything anyway. But I wind up stumbling and going, getting on to the ballpark, and I sit there on the bench, you know, playing with my thumbs or whatever. And lo and behold, the manager tells me to get out there and pinch hit, and I'd look terrible, you know, a couple of times, just fall down trying to bat. And then I happen to just nick one and knock it right over the second baseman's head and get a hit. And that's what all my successes really are. They're just that little deal of suiting up and showing up, even when I don't think I've got the right clothes and I'm not sure I'm in the right place. But suiting up and showing up and doing that next right thing and loving God's kids and asking myself, what can I do to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. I love you and thank you for listening to me.